702. The Naked Scientist.
It's 22 minutes to 3 o'clock, and as promised, the Naked Scientist joins us just after 2:30, and that's where he fields your science-related questions. So give us a call on 011-883-0702, you'll speak to Chris about science-wise what's on your mind. One of the stories that I was certainly tracking over the holidays was the outbreak, the pneumonia outbreak in China, and I thought this is certainly one I'd love to hear Chris's views on. Good afternoon, Chris. Do we have Chris? Where? On Skype? Abel is just like blowing his top about this particular connection with Chris Smith. So we'll keep trying to connect with him. But do give us your calls right now. I was quite concerned about this outbreak of pneumonia. It's already killed one person, and it's believed to have affected 40 others. And the cluster of infection that has been reported from that particular part of China raised fears about a potential epidemic, because China last week said that they believe the virus that was causing it was previously unknown. I think that's the part that has everybody quite concerned, especially from the World Health Organization, an unknown type. But they believe that it came from the same family of viruses that caused the SARS and MERS epidemics. And so, you know, those in the science community are probably much closer in how these viruses, these epidemics, or these outbreaks, I should say, are being tracked. And what do we know now about this? And I think even with avian flu, it emerged from China, and there were all sorts of deaths that were going on, but they weren't reported to the major authorities. And by the time the world woke up to it, when it comes to avian flu, it had spread quite a bit. And so when it comes to the Chinese population, there are quite a lot of specialists around the world, and disease control centers around the world always sit up and take a note if there is an outbreak. And I think we do have Chris now. Good afternoon, Chris.
Hello. Happy New Year, if I'm still allowed to say Happy New Year on the 13th of January. When are we not allowed to anymore?
I heard someone say from the 6th, but I think generally people extended to... No, I think Christmas, that's when you bring down the Christmas decorations, latest by the 6th.
Well, 12th night, isn't it? So, but anyway, I have, in your honour, extended that deadline.
Thank you.
At least my definition of it, to today. So Happy New Year. Happy New Year, everybody. Lovely to be back.
Happy New Year to you too, Chris. May you have a fabulous 2020, as we are calling it in South Africa.
So, I like that. I'm going to borrow that. Nice. I'm going to steal that. That sounds good.
Yeah. So this situation playing out in China, what do we now know? What's the latest about this outbreak of pneumonia?
Well, the story first emerged at the beginning of December. It was about the 13th of December. Mm-hmm. And cases began to appear in the local population in Wuhan City of this mysterious virus or viral infection, which was characterized by a severe pneumonia, so infection in the chest, which was compromising people's ability to breathe. And all of the cases were located in, around, or associated with a specific fish market. It doesn't just sell fish, though. They sell poultry, other things in this market. And all of the cases had characteristic X-ray changes in their chest that looked like a viral pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
They tested samples from the patients, and they tested negative for all of the usual culprits. And that included testing for the virus SARS. Now, we're not talking about the South African Revenue Service, although that's equally fearsome. They were actually talking about the severe acute respiratory syndrome, which was first documented in 2002 and then spread around the world in 2003 and affected about 8,000 people. There were 700 to 800 deaths because of SARS.
Yes.
They confirmed it wasn't that. But they didn't say what it was, and there'd been no other information provided. And so people were beginning to worry, what is China not telling us?
Mm-hmm.
But yesterday, they revealed the genome sequence. So they've actually managed to recover the genetic information of the virus that's causing this, and confirmed that it is a previously undocumented or unidentified viral infection. It fits into a family of viruses called coronaviruses, and it is actually about 90% similar to SARS. So it's in that same family or group of viruses. It's very certain, or very, very likely rather, that what's happened here is that this is a virus that's carried by a wild animal The animal has been brought into the market, and in the market, this infectious animal has presumably given the infection to another animal in the market that's a bit more similar to a human, or it could have jumped directly into a human because there was so much of the virus off of whatever this animal was. And in the case of SARS, it was a bat. So maybe it was a bat in this market again. We don't know at the moment. But it got into these people because they'd never seen anything like this before. They had no immunity to it. So that's why they became seriously unwell. Only one person has died so far, and he had other health problems. So we're comfortable that it's not a major pathogen. But at this stage, we're just now waiting to try and understand a bit more about what this virus is. Because the sequence has now been published for the genetic information of the virus, laboratories in other countries are beginning to use various techniques to rebuild the virus from its genome up. This is possible with smallish viruses like coronaviruses. So laboratories in America are now beginning to make this virus in the laboratory so they can study it too. And then we'll learn a bit more about it and what it does, what the likely outcomes will be. At the moment, no evidence of human-to-human transmission, which is encouraging, because obviously SARS was infectious. It did transmit, and it did turn into a major international health problem. This, hopefully, will remain confined to Wuhan City, but it does remind us that there's a lot lurking out there in nature, and we mustn't be complacent. And if we bring animals into confined spaces and then expose them to things they would not normally be exposed to, there's a chance that whatever they're carrying could jump into us.
Yes, yes, and probably also vice versa, that we could also transmit something to that is of danger to them.
Well, that's true. In the common cold, things like RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, and parainfluenza virus, in us, they cause cold-type symptoms, although in very young children you get wheezy, cough-type illnesses. If you infect a chimpanzee with those agents, then they can be lethal. And chimpanzee numbers are threatened in the wild in certain parts of Africa anyway. And scientists have been able to document that there's a very big impact of people, even people who go with the best intentions to study, photograph and enjoy the chimpanzees in their natural habitat. They can pass on human viruses that we just don't even blink at onto these chimps, and they can become seriously unwell or die.
Yes, and I guess it's a sobering reminder that outbreaks are just part of reality. We just always have to be aware that it could happen. It could happen at any time. And we've had several over the existence of humanity. So there are probably a whole lot more that could come our way. So we are taking calls, 011-883-0702. Got some of your calls via text as well. I'll read those. But let's start with Alistair calling from Johannesburg. Hello, Alistair.
Hi, it's Annie and Dr. Chris, and welcome to the Roaring Twenties.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Alistair.
Go with
Hi,
another
Alistair.
Decade.
Yeah.
Question. I recently planted some chili seeds. From a Durban curry creation, Chris will be happy to know. And over about 3 weeks, they've now grown to about 5 centimetres high. However, it's fascinating to see that a few of the shoots still have the seed growing at the top point of the new plant. I sent some photos to the producer. What's going on here? It's as if the seed shoot is growing from out of the bottom of the original seed.
Right, when normally that's the root. Okay.
Yeah, the seed should be at the bottom under the earth, but it's at the top of the new shoot.
And you're saying only with some of them, not all of them?
Can I? Not all of them, no, not just all a of few. Them.
Okay.
Yeah. I think what's going on here, Alistair, and Happy New Year, and I'm delighted to hear that you share my enthusiasm for curry. And I made a Durban curry over Christmas, actually. Someone bought me a cookbook, and it has a Durban butter curry. And I had to do that, so I did it. It's very good, actually. But what's going on with your chili plants is that the seeds inside chilies are a hard cellulose outer. It's called the pericarp in a seed. And it's there as a tough outer husk to protect the sensitive embryo, which is inside there, from which the plant will grow. When the plant begins to grow, it busts open the pericarp, the root goes downwards and the shoot goes upwards from the embryo. The embryo is a supply of food that provides the plant with enough nutrition as it starts to grow and before it can do its own food production in its leaves. It sometimes doesn't detach the seed casing completely from the top shoots. It's supposed to be left behind, but sometimes it does not completely detach. So you end up with these plants that look like they've got a little Chinese hat on the top. But actually, that will just fall off. Or if you just gently pull at it, you can pluck it away and you'll see that the leaves are just in there waiting to unfurl if they haven't already. So it's literally the seed casing. It's not the actual seed itself. It's what the seed was wrapped up in to protect it when it was inside the chili plant. Good luck with your chilies.
Thank you for the call, Alistair. Next, we have Shakira in Germiston. Hi, Shakira.
Hi.
Hello.
Happy New Year.
Same to you, Shakira.
Okay, I wanted to ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
How was skin color or, yes, how was skin color originated?
Right. How old are you, Shakira? Because we love young listeners. You are?
13 years old.
Okay. So curious about skin color. Yeah. How has it evolved?
Hi, Shakira. And you're the same age as my daughter, and she asks good questions as well. The answer to this is that we evolved to have dark skin to protect us from the sun. Our ancestors first were wandering around probably about 6 million years ago. That's the last time we had an ancestor that we shared with the other animals that are quite like us on Earth today.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 million years ago, those animals were really hairy. And if you take a look at your dog, for example, you'll see that because the dog's covered in a nice thick layer of hair, the skin of the dog under the hair is pink.
Yes.
And so it was probably with our ancestors. They all had pink skin. But as we evolved to have less and less hair and became more like we are today, then suddenly we had a problem because pink skin is not well defended against the sunshine, because bright sun will damage the skin and it will also remove a chemical called folic acid. It's one of our B vitamins, which we need in order to be healthy. You make DNA using folic acid, and if you don't have enough folic acid, you can't make enough DNA, and this can give you problems with things like anemia, where you don't have enough blood cells, or you can also have problems if you try to have a baby if you don't have enough folic acid. So our ancestors evolved progressively to have darker skin, and the way they did that was to increase the activity, not the number, but the activity of a class of cells in the skin called melanocytes. And melanocytes are the cells that make melanin, which is the dark stuff in skin. So if you increase the activity of those cells, they put more melanin into the skin just naturally, and that makes the skin look darker. So our ancestors went from being pale-skinned to being dark-skinned to fend off the sunshine, because we think that our ancestors evolved in various parts of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they moved out of Africa 50, 60,000 years ago and began to colonize other bits of the world, they no longer needed to be so well defended against the sun. In fact, they had the opposite problem, which is they began to live in parts of the world where the sun wasn't strong enough, and they couldn't make enough of the hormone vitamin D, which we make in our skin. So they then evolved to have pale skin again. So skin as color has gone on this interesting journey from being pink ancestrally millions of years ago to being a dark color in our ancestors, and then some people have evolved to have pale skin again.
Right. Okay. Thank you for your question, Shakira.
Thank you.
Thank you. And keep calling in with all those science questions. That's Shakira, only 13, calling us from Germiston. And now we also have our own Tsego Modisani.
Hi, Aza. How's it?
I'm good. Happy New Year. Thank you. It's okay sometimes to use your privilege.
Yes. No, I decided I want to abuse this. And somehow it was because of this question.
Yes.
That we just heard now from Shakira.
Okay.
Chris, hi. This is Tsego here. So New Zealand, a while ago, they ordered about 120 square meters of human skin from the U.S. to treat burns of victim during that volcano period when the volcano erupted. And obviously there was a need for that, which made me ask myself a question as to whether when you do skin graft, whether you can use skin from a different race to treat the victim. So if the victim was white, can you use a black person's skin to perform the plastic surgery? Would it work?
And how is that skin generated? Is it in a petri dish in a lab somewhere?
Just the way in which we do this, in an ideal world, what we do is you get skin from the person themselves, and you use an uninjured part of the body which has got plenty of skin on it, and often they'll go for your bum, for example, and you can take a skin graft from that area, and then you transplant it to another part of your body which needs the skin, the burned area. And the benefit of doing that is that you've got skin that you're only using from yourself, so you're minimizing any infection risk and that kind of thing. It's going to be genetically compatible with you, so there's no issue from that point of view, and it should therefore have the best prospects of immediately taking on to you, and it will match your normal skin in tone and color and everything else. Now, if you use skin that someone else has given you, it might be a different color, and it will be genetically different, so there might be some immune considerations and there might be some infection considerations. Most of the time we're very good at screening for things that you could transmit via that sort of route infection wise but there's always a theoretical small risk, so we're always thinking about that. Now, you could take skin of one colour or tone and put it onto another person, but but if you ended up with that skin permanently resident there, they would end up with a patch that, of skin that didn't match. And this can be true in your own body, for example, and it does mean it tends to stand out a bit. So where possible, we try to graft skin with a skin tone or colour which is equivalent to a person's skin colour in the area that you're grafting to, if you can. But at the end of the day, skin grafts save lives. When people have bad burns and they lose their skin, you can get terrible infections and you can dehydrate very rapidly through burned skin, and this is life-threatening. Whereas if you can put a scaffolding of skin back on top, actually that skin doesn't have to survive in the long term. It actually provides a barrier and provides the body with a natural healing environment, which means that you have a much better chance of surviving a bad burn. You can eventually slough off and shed that skin and be replaced with your own skin in some cases. So it's not a given that if you did put some foreign skin onto a part of the body, you'd end up with that colour skin forever. You might end up with that bit coming off later anyway and being replaced with your own skin again. It depends on how deep the burn is and what sort of skin graft you do. So there's a range of different outcomes, but skin grafts are really important and they can save lives. And yes, we do grow skin in a test tube. You can actually make skin, or you can make some of the aspects of skin artificially in a petri dish, and that's how we make sheets of tissue that you're going to graft on to provide a barrier function in this way. So no, you haven't had to go and get somebody, rob all their skin off of them and give it to somebody else. You can take samples of skin and grow them in a dish for transplantation for this purpose.
Yeah, because I think a lot of that was coming from the US.
Thank you
for the question.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Got another one from a colleague, but I'll park that for a moment. Let's go to Warren calling from Edenvale. Thanks for your patience, Warren. Hi.
Sure, no worries. Just a short and sweet one.
Sure.
If we come from the apes and from chimps or whatever the case is, why are they still around if they've evolved?
Okay.
Or if we evolved.
Okay.
So that makes
Hi,
sense.
Warren. Cool. Yeah, this is quite a commonly asked question, because people think, well, you know, we've got here, why haven't they? But actually they have too. So if you wind the clock back 6 million years to the last time we had an ancestor that we shared with a chimpanzee and a bonobo, they don't look like that ancestor directly either. So it's not like they've stayed still and we've continued to change. Everything has evolved in parallel. So chimpanzees and bonobos have come off of that same ancestor, and so have we. And there were lots of other humanoid and what we call hominid types that were knocking around in the same sort of era over the last 6 million years. So there has been an enormous amount of evolution of all parties involved, but what we've selected for are the ones that are really successful in their environment. And chimps are really successful, bonobos are really successful, we're really successful. All the other stuff that came along in the meantime wasn't quite as successful, or led to the direct evolution into the arm that became us one way or another. So lots of things have fallen by the wayside. We're the survivors. But to say they haven't evolved is not true. They absolutely have. And so have we.
Okay. So here's the question from our other colleague. And it reads like this. It says, over the holidays, we went to Lagoon Beach in Durban. And my one-year-old, together with his nephew and nieces, went to the pools to swim. So if I could just describe it, it's a beach. It's by the beach, but it's these public pools. And they are, of course,
yeah,
of different
there.
Depths.
Yeah, I've been there. I was there in August.
Ah,
yeah,
so you know exactly what we're talking about.
I do.
Zanella goes on to say that a day later, she developed a round watery circle, like he was burnt, but it was confusing given the location of the wound in quotation mark. So the circles would emerge as the others would get healed. So they just kept, you know, coming out. And then she finally took the child to the doctor. The doctor says it's a skin bacterial infection called impetigo. We got our antibiotics and now he's completely healed. But his Zanella's question is, does this impetigo virus live in water? And how safe are public pools in terms of viruses and other bacteria?
Yeah, more likely that this is a bacterial infection rather than a viral infection. Impetigo is the manifestation of Staphylococcus aureus, which is a common skin infection. Usually it goes by the name golden staph because you get very red florid marks that have got this golden crustiness on them. The scab is a gold colour. And in fact, when you grow the bacterium on a petri dish, it makes a gold colour, which is why it's called staph aureus. More commonly associated with swimming pools, though, isn't staph aureus infection, although this can happen with a wound if you scratch yourself and anything that's on the skin can then get into the wound. More commonly with swimming pools, we see Pseudomonas infection. Pseudomonas aeruginosa is the most common bacterium, and it grows in fish tanks, it grows in hot tubs, and you get something called hot tub folliculitis, which is where the bacteria can get into the hair follicles and they produce a series of little sort of pussy spots on the skin. And this, if you've got a normal immune system, normally it'll clear up. You can put some cream on there and get rid of it. Sometimes these infections can become more serious and they require systemic antibiotics. And if this was impetigo, perhaps because of a wound that or a scratch to the skin that then Staphylococcus got into, then that may well have required a course of antibiotics to clear it up.
Wow. So there are a couple of things we could pick up from public pools.
Yeah, absolutely. Pseudomonas is the common one, and you know, hot tubs is a classic presentation. Someone says, "I went to mum friend's hot tub. We lounged around in the hot tub for a while, and now I've got this sort of this funny red skin with all these little spotty bits." That would be hot tub folliculitis, and it's very common. Pseudomonas aeruginosa infection.
Yes,
so, you know,
yes.
Stay away from hot tubs; they're bad things.
Yeah, I'm in the salon business, and I know that those chairs as well that people put their feet in for pedicures. You know, they have quite a pipe feeding system as well. And some people just end up cleaning the inside of that tub where the feet go in and they forget about the pipes because that's where some of the
absolutely
the bacteria
you've got to flush them through with chemicals like chlorine or bromine to make sure you do cleanse them properly. If the water, and let's be clear here, if the water is properly treated chemically and within proper operating standards with things like chlorine, the risk is very, very small. But in situations like beach swimming pools and things, lots of people going through the water and they may not be properly dosed with things like chlorine, then you can get infections with these sorts of things, so watch out.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Till next Monday, absolutely. That was Chris Smith, the Naked Scientist.
So you finished your run.